My name is Gary Knight, and I'm an alcoholic. I introduced or was introduced, and I should keep this short, and after all, I do have to drive him back. What I'd like to say, though, is that I had the opportunity to meet Bill with Janice, his partner, and it was about 5 years ago when Jan was stricken with a pneumonia, which was to lead to her eventual death, and Bill was her caretaker. And he needed a little bit of help in terms of doing that originally, because he tried to be a full-time caretaker without really knowing what he was doing. But boy, he tried. And I can remember when I was called over to his house once, and Jan had fallen, and he couldn't get her up, and so I helped get her up. He ended up learning from the nurses. And he ended up being a very capable full-time caretaker for Jan in the last 3 years of his life. Now, really, as I understand, this is a love story, and that we're going to hear tonight. And I'm going to tell you this, is that he would say, when he spoke from the podium back then, that he loved his wife more than he ever had. I got to be a witness to it. It's true. With that, Bill?
I'll just stand up for him. Thank you.
Okay. Well, we can
sit. Is that all right?
Yeah.
Thank you. I'm Bill Roop. I'm an alcoholic. The reason I have this up here is because today's Memorial Day. And we don't want to forget the people that have been fortunate enough to serve in the armed forces, regardless what branch. How many people, would you just stand up, the ones that have served in the military in any capacity? Thank you. This hat was given to me by Sally Palmer in memory of her father, who was a Marine. Quiet, Sally. Now, we're talking about the love story. I'm so happy to be in Miracle Land, USA again. Jesus, this is wonderful. I look around at all you miracles, you know, of which I'm one too. It's a miracle that's available to everybody. God's grace is available to everybody. Some of us choose to use it, and some choose not to. Nothing wrong if you don't use it. It's just my experience, life will be not too good. That's been mine. So I was thinking the other day, I gave a talk at 123, Easy 123, and I was thinking a little bit like Gary was talking about my wife. And this love story I'm going to tell you is the story of two alcoholics. On April 27th, 1922, Janet Lee Laura Burke was born in Woodlawn Hospital on the South Side. On July 17, 1922, little Billy Roop was born on the South Side in the same hospital. 22 years later, we got married. You know, when we come to any of us, when we come to AA, we bring everything we've ever been a part of. That's what we bring to the table. My wife, Janet, she was married into the Burke family. Her father was a very nasty alcoholic. Not verbally and mentally. He'd throw her clothes out the window at the third-story apartment, insult her in front of her dates in high school. And Jan, when he cheated, can I do something for you? I was perfect, but I just needed a little tweaking. So we meet at the Northern Trust Company in Chicago. I was working there. And the vice president brought over a new girl and said, Bill, you're going to go up to another job, and I'd like to have you break this girl in on your job. She's going to do your job. And that was Janet when we met. She was a beautiful girl. And I, because I grew up feeling that I was not very attractive and not very qualified to be around beautiful girls, I always felt a little in awe around them. I figured I was never good enough for them. So she got the job, and we're working together, and we happened to win the basketball championship in the city, and we're having a dance. And the guys asked me, Bill, have you asked anybody to go to the dance? I said, no, I haven't. They said, why don't you ask Burke? I said, hey, Burke, you want to go to dance? He says, yeah. And we danced for 64 years. Isn't that amazing? 64 years. At the time we got married, neither one of us drank. We'd go out to basketball or whatever sport it was and eat ice cream and chit-chat, you know. We smoked, but we didn't drink. It wasn't one of these stories where I discovered drink and immediately became a different person and life was perfect. When I first met drink earlier than that, I didn't think much of it. I drank some wine. It didn't particularly taste good. It didn't change me into... I was inadequate, but I stayed inadequate. The drink didn't make me adequate, you know. So Jan and I, before I went overseas, we got married. And when we got married, we had a child. And before I went overseas, Peggy was born. So I was gone for roughly 3 years overseas. And when I got back, I think I was an alcoholic. If you'd met me when I first came on the program, I wouldn't have said that, because I would have said that I've only been a problem drinker for maybe a couple of years. But it turns out that as I look back in reality, I was a problem drinker every time I started to drink. It did transform my life. It made me look different at things, you know. But the interesting thing, are there any fellows here or girls from the Navy? Any of you are in the Navy? I want to thank you all, because I became an alcoholic in Germany and France during World War II. But you guys were nice enough to help my wife become one. And she didn't even have to go overseas. You know? So I'll always be grateful to you. You know? I'll tell you a little bit of what, like, some of you don't know what it's like to be married to an alcoholic. It's fun. See, when you're married to an Al-Anon, eventually they take pity on you. But alcoholics, as you all know, we're all very self-centered. Everything revolves around me. So there's two of us, whirling dervishes, you know, bang, you know. We never had a discouraging word there. Maybe one or two. So we got married, and when I came back from overseas, there was a lot of servicemen were coming. World War II had just ended, and then the war against Japan ended, so we didn't have to go over to Japan to fight. So we came home, and I couldn't find an apartment, because there were so many people coming home wanting apartments that they could be very fussy. They wouldn't rent to anybody with kids. So I had a child, so my mother-in-law had got an apartment on the third floor. It was a dinette, kitchenette, one-bedroom apartment. And my mother-in-law and my daughter Peggy were living there. And when I came home, I moved in, so there was my mother-in-law, my daughter Peggy, and myself in the apartment. I started going to a Catholic university, Loyola First and then DePaul. And I had grown up in an Irish Catholic neighborhood. And an Irish Catholic, based on my experience from the old neighborhood, they look down on anybody who is an Irish Catholic. They look down on Polish Catholics, Italian Catholics. If you're not Irish Catholic, you're second-class citizen. Well, if you're a hook-nosed Baptist, they really look down on you. I was a hook-nosed Baptist. They thought I was Jewish, you know. Which stood me in good stead, because I played basketball on the B'nai B'rith. See, the Jewish team, the B'nai B'rith, they could only have one fellow who was a Gentile. But because I had the nose, they could sneak me in and then they could get another Gentile. So I play with the B'nai B'rith, now I play with the CYO team at St. Burns. So I play with the Catholics, play with the Baptists. I wasn't any good, but I played, you know. I used to tell you I was good, but as you get to 86 and getting closer to God, reality sets in. And you're going to hear a lot of reality tonight. One time, so here we are living in this apartment. At the end of my first year at Loyola, I came home and my wife said, "Bill, I'm pregnant." And I said, I said, "That's great." Never once did it ever enter my mind that it wasn't a blessing. I just thought, geez, that's wonderful. So at the end of my second year, sophomore year, I was going to DePaul. I came home one night and my wife said, "I'm pregnant." I said, "Geez, that's wonderful." Third year, the same way. Now, if you can count, you'll realize that we're in a one-bedroom, dinette, kitchenette with my mother-in-law, my wife and I, my daughter Peggy, my son John, my son Bill, and finally my son Richard. The apartment hadn't got any bigger, but it was heavily populated. And what was interesting about it, I was the only guy in our crowd that was married. So we used to have parties at our house. 20 couples would come. It's unbelievable. You know, in Yankee winters, it's cold, you'd have a party. And they'd put their coats on top of the beds that my four kids were sleeping in. But she still talks about how he used to have to claw to the top of the coats to get to breathe, you know. I don't understand it, but my wife used to bitch a lot. She was home all day with the four kids, and I'm out at the university. One night I was coming home from university, and I got my wife, what was it, Gary? Banana cream? Banana cream. Sometimes I say banana cream, sometimes I say lemon meringue, and Gary gets excited. If I say the wrong one, you know, I don't want Gary excited. He's driving. I went to school in the morning and went to work in the afternoon. I got this beautiful banana cream pie, and I'm taking it around to the bars, and I'm showing the people, "This is my wife's favorite." And they said, "Well, let's cut it." "You can't cut that pie. That's my wife's." I did that at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock. I finally got home at 3 o'clock. And my wife started raising hell with me after I had protected her pie. She was Irish and she was a mouthy bitch. Oh, yeah. So I got mad and I took that pie and I fired it at the wall, which is about a foot away. And the meringue, it got like glue. And it would stick and then piece would fall off. Another piece would fall off. That was a fun night. I didn't tell you about another fun night. I'd been out for a couple of days drinking. And when I came home, I came home because I wanted rest. Jesus, if I'd had any energy, I wouldn't have come home. I just wanted to come. I wanted rest. So I got upstairs, and my wife is bitching. "I should never have married you. You never take me anywhere. All I am is stuck with these kids and my mother-in-law, you know, just raising hell." So being a good husband, I thought, "Well, I'll take you out." So I took her down to the neighborhood bar in Chicago. None of the guys were there. They were all home. They were married to future Al-Anons. So once they get hell, they go home and go to sleep. Not when you're married to an alcoholic. Jesus, their mouth. Anyway, so I didn't want to hit her. I tried slapping her. That don't work. Irishmen like to fight. It's not a good practice hitting Irishmen. They enjoy that more than drinking. So I knew that wasn't going to work. But I remember in the service when I take a prisoner, they taught us if you lay him on his stomach and then take a rope and put it around their feet, pull them up, and then go around, put their head, pull it back, put a rope around, you get them bowed, and then you got a tighter hand. Well, they don't like you doing this, so they yell. So what you do is you hold their nose, and when they take a breath, you stick a cloth in, handkerchief or something. I just got done doing this to my wife. My mother-in-law was yelling, "God is love, God is love." She was right, but her timing was poor. And then there were two tall men in our living room. And they were policemen, detectives. See, I made a mistake. I'm a Baptist. Any Baptists in the group, raise your hands. Don't be ashamed. That's right, there's one or two. See, Baptists don't sin. You would never think of calling the cops if you're a Baptist. Irishmen would have no trouble at all. My mother-in-law had been putting up with her husband for years. When I started acting goofy, she called the cops, and here they came. And I'm telling this one cop, look, I'm a lawyer. I didn't invite you here. And as soon as I get my gun, I'm running your ass off. The other cop's out in the kitchen, which is about 3 feet away, and he's saying, I said, what do you want? He says, how do you do that? He wanted to know, he maybe had a wife to tie up, or a girlfriend, you know. Now you can get an idea, this is a different age that I grew up in. Today they bury me under the prison. But back then, I never was punished for anything I ever did. Never went to jail for anything I ever did overnight. That ain't true today. Boy, they get you on everything today. Anyway, so that was a fun night. Well, anyway, Jan and I were having so much fun. I graduated from DePaul, and we moved out to Park Forest. And after we got out there, it was different because we were no longer the same habit patterns, new people, what have you. That lasted a week. I went into a bar out there called the Dawn Club, and I came home and I said, Jan, gee, I met the greatest bunch of people. Here we go again, you know. I'll give you a story about the Dawn Club. One time I was in a town east of Park Forest is Chicago Heights, and then there's East Heights, the eastern part. Chicago Heights had a lot of Italians. In fact, Capone used to run from Cicero to Chicago Heights, and they still had a mafioso hit there. Probably has today. These Italians are good people. They work hard. And they would own a hardware store. They'd own a cab company. They're all in the bin. But they also did things like white slavery and things that the government frowned upon. But they were nice people, hardworking people. So I was supposed to get a pizza. So I went over to Chicago Heights to get a pizza. As I'm driving over there, all of a sudden, this squad car's in front of me, and one's in back of me, and I got to stop. And so the Chicago Heights cop says, get out of the car. Well, I couldn't get out on the left, the driver's side, because I loaned it to a fella, and he wrecked it. Didn't bother me. I just parked the good side so they could see I was successful, you know. But yeah, I couldn't get out there, so I started to slide out to get out on the other side. Up in Chicago, the cops used to, the detectives, and they would carry a leather strap with a lead weight in it, and they would flick you with this thing, knock you cold. I had a relative on the force, and so I'd take this thing, and we'd flick redwood table, picnic table, and split. This guy's about to do this to my head as I get out. He's mad because I didn't get out on the left side. So I duck. He hits the top rope. I come up underneath and got him in a karate chop. And down he went. He was out cold. And I'm standing there watching him. Two Park Forest cops are trying to keep the other Chicago cop off me. And the reason I was watching him, I'd never seen this work. I was trained. Every time I tried to do it, somebody just haul off and smash me, you know. But it worked that night. So now I got to go to the police. They take me over to jail. The judge is there in Park Forest. Oh, and this guy, when they revived him, he made his second mistake. He drove my car. he comes down 26th Street into Chicago, into Park Forest. There's a red light. He's going, they tell me, he's going 45 miles an hour. He puts on the brake. He goes right through. Damn near gets killed. See, my car worked, but if you wanted the brake to work, you pumped it. If you wanted the window to go down, you tap it to go down. If you wanted the windshield wiper, you'd tap it and go down and reach around and go, shh. No. So the car worked, but you didn't know how to work it. And I was mad because I didn't give authority to take it anyway. I wanted to arrest him for stealing my car, but that didn't fly too good. But anyway, all you had to do then was put your two fingers together and walk a line. If you do that, you weren't drunk. How are your kids like that today with the drug tests and all that? That's all we had to do. So my car has been impounded because it was a faulty vehicle. So the other cop, the one I had in deck, she's driving me to my house. And he says to me, Mr. Roop, he says, I would have sworn you'd been drinking. I said, well, being a lawyer, you can't be tried twice for the same crime. It's unconstitutional. I explained this to him, and as I did, I looked down, I'm in handcuffs. Now I'm in a Chicago Heights jail. It won't do any good to be a lawyer there. So I became a member of the mafia. I started yelling, I'm a member of the mafia, and I don't know what happened. I'm locked up. They've impounded my car. Chief of police comes down, and next thing I know, I'm released. I figure he must have called the guy. He don't know. I could have been a hitman from Detroit. You know, you can't lock up people. All of a sudden, they give my car back, and I'm free. So I go back to the Dawn Club. It's about 2 o'clock in the morning, and as I walk in, they all look up at me and say, where's the pizza? And that was the story of my life. I could go out for pizza and became a three-ring circus. Drinking got worse. I got evicted from Park Forest. The guy that owned Park Forest was two Jewish fellows that got the money from the government and built it. But that guy told me, the first time he said, Mr. Rupert, you got to pay your rent. You're back 2 months. I'm not the type of guy that would run out on you. My families have done some problems. These five kids we got, I've got five. They've done some damage. I'm not leaving you to lurch. I'll take care of this. Second month, the same thing. The fourth month, he says, Bill, just get the hell out. He said, if you ever get sober, come on back. But get out. So I had to leave. But so now I'm out in Steger, Illinois. The kids don't know anything. All the kids know we're moving. People came to move me. We were out in Steger. A lot of animals around. The kids used to see the animals when they're going to school. The kids tell me today. So nobody was, but I felt terrible. I was a bad father. I was a bad husband. I wasn't taking care of the little birds that had to be fed all the time. They get to their nest, and their mother, because I wasn't capable of doing it, you know. I don't know how the hell I ever kept the balls together. So we're out in Steger. And on January 3rd, 1957, I woke up on the floor of a girl's house. So sick of me, I couldn't stand me. And she called some outfit. I didn't know what it was, didn't know anything about AA. She called, and I said, what's that number you called? Give it to me. She gave it to me, and I went home. And I called. It was the AA number. And after an hour or two guys came over. I wasn't impressed with them. One guy shook his head like this in my living room. I figured, this guy's goofy. And the other guy told me he was a general foreman at U.S. Steel, and he hid bottles in his locker. I said, geez, now I'm going to have to hang around with Polacks from the steel mills. I should have never made that phone call, you know. But being a Baptist, I figured if you call the minister once, you ought to go to church once. They wanted me to go to a meeting. It was in Chicago Heights on a Wednesday night. Some guy was running his mouth like I'm doing. There were kids there. Just women there. I said, just look like any Baptist church on a Wednesday night. I'm getting the hell out of here. Except another guy was taking me home. And this guy drove a old Packard. It was not old at the time, but a beautiful old Packard with the side wheel mounts on the side. Gorgeous guy. You kids don't know what I'm talking about. But it was a gorgeous. Jerry Barber does, because Jerry's just reached 90. But he took me home, and as we got out to my house in the country, he started telling me that I should go to a closed meeting. And I explained to him that I owned a company, and I hadn't been taking care of business. So really, I should devote my time to the business. And he kept jabbing me with a cigar. You know, I'm ducking him. I should have decked him, but I didn't. Yeah, I was 34 and he's about 54. I could have hit him with impunity. You know, anyway, I started to laugh at him. I said, all right, I'll go. It was the greatest decision I ever made. I went to a close meeting of Homewood 17. Most of you people couldn't stand Homewood 17. I don't know if there's any of you that could. Homewood 17 was a great outfit. Great, especially if you're into sobriety. They might have had a big book there, but if it was dusty. Nobody had opened it. Homewood 17 would start, people would be arriving about 8 o'clock, 8:30, say, you're going to lead the meeting. So you get up there and you'd say, hey, anybody have any problems today? Well, here's how we handle them, you know. And the meeting would go until midnight. Now, see, we're pretty smart people, alcoholics. The reason it went till midnight was because Catholics couldn't eat meat on Friday night. And if the meeting ended at 11, the Protestants would have eaten all the ham sandwiches. So the Catholics would make it last until midnight, then they could eat them. See? First meeting I went to, geez, I like these people. They were just like guys from the bars. They were all talking about World War II, and they were lying. Hot dog, I fit right in. You know, but they had this fixation on not drinking. God, they're always talking about not drinking. Why the hell would you not drink? So after it was over, a guy comes up to me and he says, Bill, can you stay away from a drink for a day? And I said, why would I want to do that? I got 5 kids, Bill Clay, everybody's after me. The only time I don't feel suicidal is when I'm in the bag. As soon as I get sober, you know, I get a drink again. I'll kill myself, but I'll do it tomorrow. So drink kept me alive, keeps a lot of people alive. Keeps them from committing suicide, too. Yeah, same thing. So, that started me. Now, at that time, they had what we call a dry dime therapy. A person would take a dime and put it in the machine and call up, and then two of us would go get them. Two men, if it's a man, two women, it's a woman. Well, at that time in Park Forest, most of the people had jobs except me. So when the phone would ring, I'd go out and one person. I remember the first time I answered the phone, and this guy was in trouble, and I went and got him and ended up taking him to a drying out place, which was Washingtonian. It cost you $100 for 5 days back then. And you had to have an alcoholic bring in. I learned that list from my sponsor. I said, this guy says he needs help. And he said, Jack told me what to do, so I did it. And I took him up to Washingtonian, and I picked him up on Easter morning to bring him home. And all he said to me, this guy Bill Lambert, said, did you tell my wife I'm an alcoholic? Now don't forget, I'd only been sober a short period of time. I hardly talked to my wife, let alone to your wife, you know. And I don't know anything about Al-Anon. It's just really started in Park Forest. I got enough trouble with me. So I went to a Homewood 17 meeting on Friday night, and Lambert comes up to me and he says, Bill, I had to tell on you. I said, what'd you tell? He said, I had to tell why I drank. Why did you drink? Because you didn't tell my wife I'm an alcoholic. So I told him in very Yankee, positive profanity what I thought of him, his ancestry, and his future, and how much I cared about him. Now, when I first came down to Atlanta, I used to share the vocabulary, but you Southerners have cured me of that stuff, for which I'm eternally grateful. Lambert stayed alive for 17 years. He lost a big house, he lost the cars, lost the wife, lost everything, but he didn't die. So anybody that's 12-stepping, our job is only to carry the message. Our job, like I said to my sponsor, I said, what do I do with this guy? He says, Bill, you're just the messenger. Your job is get him to the meeting. God speaks at the meeting. He says, he'll hear what he's supposed to hear, or he won't hear it. But don't ever get deluded that you're the guy that's going to heal him. That ain't it. So that's what I've been doing. So I got very active in Homewood 17. By God, I got active. You know, if I started a picnic, which became 500-person picnic, big picnic, we had meetings going on, I tried to destroy AA. One of my pigeons said, what the hell did he say? He says, why don't we read this? So I said, read it. I looked at it and I said, what, is this a library outfit? You want to read, go to the library. This is a program of sharing your strength at home. You're not reading. That was how it works. It just came to Chicago. See, I tried to destroy it, but I can't, you can't. It's a God thing. Even Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson couldn't. They tried, they said. It's a God thing. Oh, Homewood 17 was an interesting outfit. I go back to that briefly because it's Memorial Day. When I was drinking, one of my friends in the bar was a fellow named Tom Everhart. He was an airline pilot, and he came in AA 2 years before I did. So when I came in, Tom had told everybody in Park Forest groups, he says, the heroes are coming into AA. He said, for example, this fellow, Bill Roop's a hero. He's got the Congressional Medal of Honor. Now, people would come up from the Park Forest group and ask me about my Congressional Medal of Honor. One girl came up and she said, would you like to talk about your war experience? I said, no, I don't want to talk about it. So I got the reputation of being a humble hero. Until 6 months later, some Yankee broad came up and says, what's this Congressional Medal of Honor bullshit? And I said, I don't have it. But I had it for 6 months in AA, and that's longer than you guys ever had it, I'll tell you that. I thought that was apropos for Memorial Day. I had told Tom Everhart one night when I was drinking, I don't know, he wasn't in, he had something wrong, he was a pilot, and he wasn't in World War II, so I accused him of being a 4F in my cups, and he said, you didn't. So anyway, one thing led to another. I took him home, had my wife get the medal box out and showed it to him. I don't know what the hell he could have seen, but it made an impression on him. Boy, he told everybody in town, you know, you come in AA, guy got 2 years, airline pilot, got a nice job, nice. You believe him. So I had people believe, and I was sort of sorry that it stopped, but... Jesus, I love the... You know what? One of the great things about speaking at this page in my life, I'm 86, and I'll probably be going through the pearly gates before a lot of you. There's a few here that I'll probably go to your funeral, I can say that. But logically, I should go first, you know. You see, everything I ever talked about, from the podium, too, about my war experiences was true. Every one of them, I think. They just never happened to me. Well, God, that takes care of those lies. See, if you guys come in and you got this program and put the cork in the jug, you became a saint and you did everything right. That ain't my story. I was still the same SOB, like you. One guy down in Florida used to say, you sober up a drunken horse thief, you got a sober horse thief. And that's what I was. I was still kiting checks. I was still trying to get balls in the air. But I kept sponsoring people. See, if you don't really improve and work the steps, you want to keep sponsoring people. See, because I'd get a new guy. I'd tell him, we don't drink and we go to meetings. And our life gets better. And then after about a month, he sees I'm still cheating and lying and stealing. He don't want to really have you as a sponsor. So you got to get another one. Then you tell him, we don't drink, life will get better. Then he finds out you ain't really living the life. So if you're going to do that, you got to get in sponsorship. You'll get very active in sponsorship. Because as soon as they find out you're a phony. See, the reason I'm perfect today... The reason I have improved is because everybody I ever sponsored was better than me. They were better than me drunk. They were drunk better than me. I sponsored a seat. The first guy I sponsored was a criminal lawyer from the city of Chicago, Art O'Donnell. I didn't know I needed a criminal lawyer. I did. Didn't know it, but I did. Arnold Donald was the first guy. He's an honest guy for a criminal lawyer. He worked. He's a workaholic. Jesus, I wasn't working at all. You know, he's a workaholic. The next guy's sponsor was a CPA, lawyer and a CPA. Oh, incidentally, I'm only a lawyer when I drink. I don't want to confuse you. You know, I thought I'd tell you that because I forget sometimes and people think I'm a lawyer. Anyway, so I sponsored this guy as a CPA and a lawyer. He's a pretty honest guy. So I couldn't be dishonest. See, God kept sending me people to sponsor that were to help me. Now, 52 years later, what do I tell my pigeons? In fact, I told a young girl right here that her job, she met Sally. Her job wasn't to help Sally. I mean, Sally's job wasn't to help her. Your job is to make Sally better. Because she needs a lot of help. See, my pigeons don't look to me for help. They figure, geez, we ought to polish Roop up and make him more honest and make him more help him with his things that he never had. Even. That's why they sent me south. See, I grew up in a Yankee land, and, you know, we don't have any culture. They sent me down here to learn how not to swear, how to be perfect, how to love the Southern girl, and I've done that. You know, and anyway. Jesus. Homewood 17. Let's you notice I haven't talked about the big book. I'm 7 years sober. I went to some big book meetings, step meetings. See, after 2 or 3 years, I went to my sponsor and said, I don't think I'm going to make it. He said, why? Are you thinking of having a drink? I said, no, I never thought of having a drink since I came in here. But I can't stand me. He says, well, now it's ready to work the steps. See, the steps, this is a gospel according to Ruth. None of those steps say don't drink. The steps aren't in chapter 1. Chapter 1 in the big book says, I'm Bill Wolfson. I had a problem with drinking. Chapter 2 says there's a way out. There's a solution. Chapter 3 gets into chapter 4 to the egg. It isn't until chapter 5 it gets into the steps. So I used to feel guilty because I didn't get into the steps. Anybody today that goes to a hospital, they go into the steps because a hospital ain't got anything to give you. They took from AA to take the steps to give it to you, and that's great. But if you're a guy like me that was... I remember Houlihan and I used to talk that we're so crooked that when we die, they'll have to screw us into the ground. We just can't lay down flat, you know. We walked in this outfit and we found pure mental health. Jesus, if you're a real jerk, that's the last thing you need is pure mental health. And they tell you, you got to get a God. Jesus, the only part of God, you know. But I'm out there sponsoring people. You know. Had that down pat. So I come down to... Oh, and Houlihan and I were sitting outside of a meeting one night, and Houlihan was Mayor Daley's nephew. Well, he's married to Daley's niece. And Houlihan and I used to go out drinking in the bars, and Houlihan worked for the county recorder's office. He had a briefcase, and then there were licenses. So we'd sell them to you in a bar. You want a driver's license? We'd sell it to you. Never turn anything in, you know. And we'd sell a marriage license. You want? We'd sell dog light. We'd sell the licenses. Well, Mayor Daley found out about this, and he fired Houlihan. Imagine a mayor firing his own kin. Anyway, I got fired for a little innocent thing like commingling funds. It's an innocuous thing. What it is I'd always have company money in my pocket. And I'd be out in a bar, and I'd see some girl like Yassine that needed spiritual help and guidance. And I only had $2 of my own money. And that didn't last long, so we went into partnership. That's called commingling, and you don't let the partner know that it's a partnership. What it is stealing. See, my sponsor told me that. So anyway, I was active up in AA, and God sent me down here. Oh, and Houlihan. So we knew that he could never be in politics because of what he did. And I never could work for a major company again because of what I did. And that night, we were absolutely right. 2 years later, I was the district manager in charge of the Midwest for McGraw-Hill, and Houlihan was elected representative in the state of Illinois. In AA, the key to let you into the house of AA is putting the cork in the jug. That's the key that lets you in. Where you go in this house depends on you. As you walk into the house and you come out of the cold weather and you're laying on the floor in the concrete by the furnace, you're cold and miserable. Then you get warmer and then you smell food. You walk upstairs, you get good food. You start walking down the hall and you see a chapel there. You go to another place, there's a library, beautiful artwork. In other words, you can go anywhere you want in AA, but you got to pay the price. But the key to get in is not drinking. And I don't care if you're a saint. If you drink, it's all over. Because you don't go back to where you were. However long, I've been sober 52 years. If I go back drinking, it's not back where I was 52 years ago. It's today. So not drinking is just the most important thing in my life. But if you want to be able to live in your own skin, those steps are the answer. What do they do? 1, 2, 3. I can't, he can't, I think I'll let him. It gets God in your life right away. I usually remember them, but I hope they're up here. Anybody got the steps? Pardon my back. Step four.
Well, here's a small version.
I don't care. 1, 2, 3, it's God. You got to get God in your life. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. I never made a fearless and moral inventory of myself at all. After about 2 years, I went to my sponsor because I got a letter from a district attorney. He was going to prosecute me, maybe, for theft. And I was upset. Here I am when I was drinking. I wanted to be punished for what I did. Now I'm in AA, starting meetings, sponsoring people, doing everything right. And these bastards are after me. Yeah, it ain't right. So I went to my sponsor. And I got done telling him on it. He said, Bill, did you take something that didn't belong to you? And I said, yeah. He says, then you're a thief. See, up until that, I was not a thief. I was a nice guy. I came from a good family. Thieves were somebody else. AA taught me what I was. That was important. Admitted to God, to myself, another human being, the exact nature of wrong. Didn't do that to begin. I've done it many times since. When I came down to Atlanta after 7 years, I got involved with the steps. I got involved with step meetings. It was like a whole new... The only way you can purge yourself is by getting God and using Him and finding out what you're bringing to the table. See, when I started at the beginning, I said, Jan came here and was born into a family where the guy treated her like terrible. That triggered and crippled her psyche. It never changed. When I felt my father had abandoned me, that crippled my psyche and it doesn't change. Whatever you bring to the table, you got your own problems. So that's what's interesting when two people in AA get married. These two problems, bang, you know. Jan and I did it, and it worked out. I became entirely ready to have God remove my wrongs. The fact that I had wrongs, it wasn't their fault. See, this outfit here will teach you not to be a victim. A lot of people commit, it ain't my fault. No, as long as it ain't your fault, why the hell would you get sober? Keep drinking. It ain't your fault. Die! It ain't your fault. The only way you can get sober is if it is your fault. Then you can do something about it. And you've got power to do it with God's help. Without God's help, you're dead. I don't know if I had love what Sandy Beach says. He says to some new guy, he said, do you go to church? He goes, no, I don't like church. Do you read any spiritual books? No, not me. Don't get me reading that stuff. Do you believe in Jesus? Oh, hell no. How's it working? How's it working? You wouldn't be here if it was working, so you got to change. But I don't want to change. Well, keep keep doing what you're doing, you're going to keep getting what you're getting. And that's true of me. I wake up and I'm like, today I'm, people have known me, I mean, you know, today I'm into love. I happen to be a Jesus guy, and my God said to me, you got to love God with all your heart and all your soul, love your neighbors and so I believe that. Try to practice it. And he said, feed the sheep, John 21. So that's what AA is. Get a higher power, live the life, and feed the sheep. Come and give it out. So I'm into love, and I'm sitting at the Gwinnett room. I get there early, and there's a young lady sitting across the table from me. And I said, sit down. She doesn't say hello to me. Doesn't even establish eye-to-eye contact with me. Doesn't do anything. I think, who's this bitch? Boy, that love disappeared fast, didn't it? Then, because I've been around so long, I said, hi. I don't believe I've met you. She said, I just walked in. I've never been here before. See? All my life, the problem is rope. They tell me what to do. I don't do it. I get the penalty. I did it. If I give of myself to you, I get the benefit. There's a spiritual law of sowing and reaping. Whether you like it or not, it's a fact. You reap, you sow manure, you're going to reap manure. Don't think you ain't. You've already done it. If you sow love, you're going to reap love. All I got to do is walk into at Christmas time, a bunch of my pigeons, we go to the mall at Lenox, and the girls are harassed with last-minute shoppers. I'd end up having them smiling and laughing because pretty soon they're all laughing. My pigeon would say, why the hell? How can you do that? These people are miserable. It's the last day. I said, because life's a mirror. What you put out, you're going to get back. Now, if you think this is not true, try smiling at people. Try loving people. At the prison, I tell the guys, I said, I love all of you. Don't even know you. I love everybody in the room here. I don't know. Because love to me means I wish you well. That's all it means to me. It's not agape love or brotherly love or erotic love. It's just I wish you well. I hope that everything goes good for everything you're going to do. That's what love means. But what does that do for me? It heals me. It heals me. What you give, you get. So that's how the love story went. Jan and I got married. We got on the program. She got on the program. She died sober, 64 years. During that time, we both had a great deal of growing up. But the last 5 years of my life, with me being able to take care of her, I loved that woman with a love that was pure. A love that was unbelievable. I never thought, a selfish SOB like me? I used to have to rotate her every 2 hours, every night. I'd get up and I'd say, how you doing, Jan? She's, advanced stages of Alzheimer's, but she know me. Those are the happiest years of my life. I get the message I'm saying, no matter how screwed up you are when you get here, if you don't drink and you're not perfect with the steps, keep sticking around. Don't drink. Try to live the steps. You'll get opportunities. After 52 years, I still get opportunities for emotional growth. This is a program not just to get sober. It's a program because of my drinking problem. It brought me to the realization through God's help for this program. And today, I love Bill Roop. I love you all. Because when I came here, I hated Bill Roop, and I was scared. Today, I'm not scared. God and I are important. It's such a nice crowd. I thought I'd tell you a little something about somebody up in Chicago. Where I grew up, there was an Irish Catholic neighborhood, and these two Irish Catholic people got married. They were 20 years old. And when the baby came out, it was nothing but a head. Didn't have any arms, didn't have any legs. But everybody liked the head in the neighborhood. Head went to parochial school, became very popular, became president of the class in parochial school. High school, became a cheerleader. And everybody liked the head. So when the head got to be 18 in Chicago, you could drink beer. So everybody in the neighborhood went down to the neighborhood bar. Brought the head up and put it up on the bar, and they all yelling, "Hey, head." And the mother said, "Give the head a drink." They gave him a beer. And a miracle happened. Little legs came out, little arms came out, little body came out. And the head's running up and down the bar, and everybody's cheering for the head. Hot diggity. And the mother said, "Give the head a..." And the father said, "Give the head a drink." Gave him another drink. And the head fell over dead. And the bartender said, "He should have quit when he was the head." I hope you quit while you're ahead. And I'm going to stay quit while I'm ahead. Thank you.
We just heard from the love man. Thank you, Bill.
First I slept, and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart. Promises are real. And I always long for something that set me free. And I love to over. Take me where